Hello and welcome to Arcane Connection. In tonight's episode, Tom and I will be discussing story flaws. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Chris.
So, it's been a while. We recorded an extra episode this week, which took us to 23. Remember I said many years ago that I was going to do 23 podcasts at least?
Yes.
Because most of the historical Ars Magica fan scenes got to 22 and stopped.
Right.
21 or 22. So we're doing better than some, though we've been doing this for over a decade now.
Yes.
So we don't have a very...
reliable. There's long stretches of not producing anything, but we're back in the game.
Oddly enough, most of the time when we don't produce stuff, it's because we're running an Ars Magica campaign.
Yes.
And we've now got to the point where we've got one that's coming to an end, haven't we?
We have. And that can be the subject of a future episode, how to end your saga. But for now... So we're still thinking about characters, setting up your characters for your first game. Story flaws.
Story flaws. And, okay, so what is the purpose of a story flaw? I mean, if you go back to the old White Wolf games, they were very strong on virtues and flaws. But
yeah.
I don't think you get virtues and flaws in many role-playing games. Champions, I think, had something like it, didn't it?
Yes, that was all about how to represent your superhero by purchasing all the stuff, but also to offset that you had your weaknesses like Superman and his Kryptonite.
And then there was Steve Jackson Games GURPS.
Which was all about the virtues and flaws, and one of the great joys of the GURPS, you can simulate anything by having the right combination of things. The great problem with GURPS is choice paralysis. Somebody trying to create a character will sit through and work through every possible advantage that might work for that character and have to discard some along the way and spend many, many hours wasting time.
And that's part of the problem with Ars Magica, is that learning how to create a character is quite painful when you've got so many story flaws and virtues and flaws.
But if you just choose from the few ones which are right for you, you can get a character that's working, play it, and then once you've played it, that gives you more experience. I mean, when we started running the York campaign in, what, about 2010, I decided to try it short-range magic as a flaw because I thought, that's one I've never considered trying before, I'll try it. Crippled the character, and then we ended up playing the game for years and years. So for years, my character would do all sorts of things, except cast spells at anyone at a range.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things about virtues and flaws is every character has them, and for a wizard, it's going to be 10 of one and 10 of the other. For a grog, you get 3 virtues, 3 flaws, and they're all minor, yeah. Aren't they?
Yes, and no story flaws.
And no story flaws. But today we'll be talking about companions and magi who have 10 points of flaws and 10 points of virtues.
Yeah.
And in 4th edition and earlier editions of Ars Magica, a flaw cost you a certain number of points, like
yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or 6.
Yes.
But in 5th edition, everything is made either a minor flaw, which costs 1 point, or a major flaw,
which costs three.
So 1 and 3. So you could theoretically have 3 major flaws and a minor, is that right?
You could.
I think there's a limit, and I'm trying to remember how it works.
So, limits, you're only allowed 1 story flaw. Personality flaws, you're allowed 1 major and 1 minor for... Magi and companions, Grog's allowed 1 minor.
Right, but isn't there a limit that you can't take more than 5 minor flaws or something like that?
I don't remember seeing that one.
I mean, we've only been playing this game for 20 odd years. So.
Do you know what? I don't think that actually. I mean, do you know what? I'm sure you can. It's just usually people get so bored. By the time you've got that many minor flaws, people get so bored of reading their character sheet. Oh, do you know what? A central character. They have up to 10 points of flaws, but no more than 5 minor flaws. It is there in the second paragraph of the Virtues and Flaws chapter.
That's what I thought.
You're absolutely
yeah.
right.
Yeah, so you can't have more than 5 minor flaws. Now, the problem is they have to balance. So if you take so many points of virtues, you have that many points of flaws as well.
Yeah.
The way to get around it is to, I think, when you're first starting out, is just take a couple. Just take something that appeals to you.
Yeah.
You need to take a hermetic flaw, don't you, if you're a wizard?
Oh, Do you know what? I'm not 100% sure you have to. They just say they advise it to make your magic a bit different.
Tom is now going to read the rules and check.
Okay, so with hermetic ones, it just says these are only available to people without hermetic training.
Anyway, you usually should take a hermetic floor. And
if you're a magus, yeah.
Yeah, if you're a magus. But any character, I mean, the general floors are absolutely crippling. They're things like...
The ones from the core book are the ones in the Grogs book, because Grogs, having needed...
Don't worry about that for the moment. Let's stick with the main book. So, from the main book, which is what I advise playing with, if you take a general floor, it's something like leprous or no arms, no legs, no head.
So, yeah, the major general ones, things like being blind or deaf, not being able to spend confidence points or having no hands, pretty crippling. The minor ones, you can probably find a couple you can live with, but if you try to load up on too many of them, your character will have
slightly problematic anyway, because I mean, I know people who are blind and play roleplay games very happily and live very happy lives. I know plenty of people are deaf. I myself am partially deaf now, hence the fact I'm so annoyingly loud. And, you know, all of those so-called flaws, but they're flaws in terms of character utility.
Yeah.
People like me who are obese, it's a flaw because I will die quicker and I cannot run to the bottom of my road without coughing my lungs up. Well, I can, but no further. And, you know, at the end of the day, many of these flaws, we might know people who have it. Now, one of the controversial ones you'll find in there is transvestite, and
it's now errated.
It's now errated and is no longer, what is it now? It's just a how's it changed?
I think it's now gender non-conforming. It's now more all about how society reacts to you rather than
exactly. And I mean, the thing is, actually, to be honest, if you're gender non-conforming and passing, which was the case in people in the Middle Ages, some would.
Yeah.
Also, notions of gender in the Middle Ages vary wildly from region to region and across the spectrum of time. So, you know, there certainly were gender non-conforming individuals, the most famous of them being Joan of Arc.
Yes.
She's later, but I mean, Joan of Arc is a clearly gender non-conforming individual who goes on to become fabulously, well, to become a saint eventually, but that's whether or not you, there's a lot we could say about Joan of Arc. We should probably do an entire discussion of her one day. Anyway, let's get back to virtues and flaws. So these are not value judgments. Because something is a flaw does not mean it's, you know, reprehensible in any way. It's just it restricts your character's capacities in some way,
or will force certain stories upon you,
exactly,
or force certain choices,
or will lead you into adventures.
Yeah,
so I might have the floor unnecessarily garrulous.
Oh, I'm looking down the list of floors and seeing quite a few that apply to you, Chris.
Oh, thank you. Go on then, tell me which floors apply to me.
Well, I'm looking at the general minor list of clumsy, incomprehensible, and you've already owned up to poor hearing.
Yeah, keep going.
I don't know. Does obese count for us?
Maybe, but keep going, because I think you're about to come to berserk, bloodlust, violent, vengeful.
See, now, while vengeful is a flaw, being berserk, that's an advantage, because it helps you be a warrior.
Okay, so in a moment, when Tom is beaten to death, you will know that the reason was that I took the advantage
of berserk. Yes.
Yeah, the virtue, not the flaw. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, yeah, there's a whole stroke. What you can do is you can cripple your character very easily. And if you try and go up to 10 points, it's really, really easy to do it.
Yes.
But a lot of players like to take the full 10 of advantages and disadvantages, don't
they? Yeah, some of my favourites have only had about 7 or 8, where you go, I've reached a point where I'm happy, but I don't want to overload my character.
Whereas I've played characters who've got sort of 4 points, one major and a minor of each, but, you know, it depends. So, virtues have different categories. We'll talk about those another time, but flaws are general flaws, which are the kind of things that make your character not quite unplayable, but certainly make their life interesting. There's an interesting question there, because, of course, if a magician can improve your eyesight. And this is the man who's wearing his dead father's glasses. Because, did you know, I crushed my glasses. They're over there, the broken remnants.
I can see some broken fragments.
And then I found a pair of glasses and I realised they were my dad's that I brought back from the hospital. But never mind, at least I can see through them. But yeah, so if you can overcome a flaw by magic, so if your character finds a way to cure their blindness, then the flaw is not a flaw.
That's a fair point.
And so therefore you have to take another flaw to balance it. So your character should always, and there are ways, you can't just solve your problems and they go away. You get new problems because otherwise the character ceases to be interesting.
Yes.
So there are those general flaws which are often horrible. Then you've got personality flaws, and Tom has the personality flaw, soft-headed, turnip-faced, and that's smells like a goat. Oh no, sorry, no, I just invented those.
And that's not personality.
No, what?
How you smell has no bearing on your personality, Christine.
No, that's quite. Social handicap. It's social.
Social handicap is still in there as a general flaw. Yes.
Right. Social handicap's not a bad one though, if you do. But God, then what are my personality flaws, Tom? As he's being so rude about me today.
Well, I'm sure your partner would claim you had some of these.
Go on.
Well, Christian, you're obviously so ambitious and driven.
Oh,
you're
yes.
Also avaricious, you know.
You're
all about that money. Chris will be busy trying to hustle his latest Patreon to you and telling you about his new Kickstarter for some fabulous project. He's all about the hustle, so ambitious, avaricious, driven. How can you take just one of these when you're as big a hustler as CJ?
Yeah, he's being sarcastic. I'm notorious for not caring about money and, in fact, regarding poverty as an apostolic virtue and something that we should embrace happily rather than complaining about. But neither here nor there. Let's just move on from this. Lots of people really don't get my attitude to money.
Yeah. Anyway, so the main focus for tonight was supposed to be story flaws. So story flaws, in previous editions of Ars Magica, many of what were now the minor story flaws would be 1 or 2 point virtues, because they, you know, things like having a mentor or having a friendly magical animal or the like, these sorts of things would be a minor virtue. Or having a fairy friend would be due to inherit something. These will be minor virtues because they'd help you out.
But nowadays, they're flaws.
Yeah, because they drag you into stories and force you to have things happen to you, they count as minor flaws.
Now, if you take a story flaw or even a personality flaw, you have to expect that your referee will write an adventure which puts your character in that adventure.
Yeah.
And which will address the exact thing in your story flaw. So if you've if you've fallen out with your family and you're the black sheep, you know there will be a story about your character's family and that the referee will define that background and will make you, you know, deal with it in the game.
Yeah.
They're not jumping on you and being cruel and bullying you, though some of the players complained, didn't they?
Yes.
That, oh no, what do you mean we're going to have, this is happening, but you can't do this to me, but you chose a story flaw.
Yes, but Christian, just because I'm a tormenting master doesn't mean they have to be a dick, wreck the entire covenant, and threaten to bring down the wrath of the mundanes upon the entire town of Glastonbury for people being turned into cows.
Well, that's exactly what a tormenting master does. He turns up and causes trouble.
But why is my tormenting master deliberately triggering the phobia of the vicious Flombo within my covenant?
Well, just because Hua Flombo is scared of cows. If you take scared of cows, then you're going to have to expect stories about cattle markets, stories that involve you having to get through a field of cattle, and stories in which cows feature, and of course comedy routines involving pantomime cows.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, cows did appear quite a bit, more than you might have maybe expected. But we did actually have a magi called Desdevarius, who was a magical cattle breeder.
Yes.
And who specialised in fairy cattle. Yes. So therefore, taking a character who had fear of cows was perhaps not such a good idea in the first place, Lloyd. So a lot of the atmosphere and the background of your game arises from you choosing those characteristics.
Yes.
Is that a fair summary?
I think that's a fair point.
So story flaws, are they worth it?
They can be. But which ones would you recommend to a newcomer?
Let's go through them and have a quick look at them. What's the first story flaw listed?
Black sheep.
That's the black sheep of the family.
Yes.
So, yeah, you're the one who's not like the rest of the family. In my experience, the rest are always wealthy, and you're always the downtrodden one if you're playing Ars Magica. But that's
enough about your real life.
Yes.
The,
But black sheep means that your family, for some reason, don't get on with you, or at least find you...
And it gives you a bad reputation, which people might use against you.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you've been unjustly accused of something by another relative.
Yeah.
Maybe you've been disinherited by your scheming siblings. Maybe your evil siblings are failing to give you the money. Maybe they've stolen your inheritance. Maybe your siblings are just dreadful people. Not that, you know.
Again, enough about your real life.
I'm joking. But all of these things, yeah, could be true. But a black sheep is clearly, you know, it's going to give the referee endless opportunity. It's very open. Now, the only problem with that is, what if your conception of your character's family is very different from the referee's? So if you really feel strongly about it, you need to talk to the referee about the kind of why you're a black sheep and how they can use it. And you've got to work out a way that's agreeable to both of you before the adventure. What's the second one?
Curse of Venus.
I quite like Curse of Venus because, I mean, you know, I suffer from it, obviously.
You do.
Yeah, women, you know, just wherever I go, women, you know, inappropriately fall in love with me, don't they? Because they can't help themselves because I'm so beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, I think we all know what it's like, don't we? So Curse of Venus is clearly fodder for comical stories.
But it does have the potential to go a little bit creepy or a little bit wrong if your gaming group it does not handle it sensitively.
Yeah, if you're happy with the referee constantly hitting on you in the as a NPC, then, you know, that's fair enough. If you're of an opposite sexual preference, or if there's some reason why you're not entirely sure, or you're playing with strangers, it can be. And it shouldn't be constant. It shouldn't be every washerwoman you meet develops a massive crush on you and pursues you down the street just because you've got Curse of Venus. It's more like, I don't know. It could be inappropriate. It could be deeply disturbing if played. If you play it for sort of Shakespearean laughs, you know, low laughs and comedy.
Or you could play it for dramatic value, like actually being as beautiful as Helen of Troy and having 1,000 ships launched because of you.
Yeah, yeah. But again, you know, I mean, I cope with that every day, Tom.
Right.
Keep going. What's the next one?
Dark Secret. So what sort of dark secret would you reckon would be fun to have as an Ars Magica character?
Read me the description of Dark Secret. I think cannibal.
Okay.
I think cannibalism is always... It's one of those dark secrets that...
You're haunted by something that would lead to shame, rejection, and possibly revenge if discovered. Hints about the secret continually arise, and there might be others who know it and could betray you. This could make you avoid certain places, dislike certain people, or fear certain things.
Well, you murdered somebody, you committed some kind of sinful deed. Oh, that would
so be... you're thinking of being Macbeth?
Maybe, or maybe the dark secret is something relatively innocuous, like...
Well, you could be. You'll remember some kind of hermetic conspiracy. You've helped cover over something...
But I still think cannibalism. Yeah. Especially if you just, you know, look around the other players and salivate and, you know, lick them occasionally experimentally. What? So why are you looking disturbed, Tom?
More things you don't want to see around your gaming table. Thank you, Christian.
No, I'm okay. What serious ones could you have? There's all kinds of possibilities for Dark Secret. Yeah. Carry on.
Dependent. So, you know, having a child to care for, an aging parent, or something like that.
Yeah, the only problem with dependent is that the referee has to put them in danger. And then some players will get quite emotionally upset when their dependent is, you know, So the dependent, you don't have to constantly have them kidnapped or suffering from horrible diseases. You can just come up with stories that involve the dependent in a more positive way, but where your child grows up, you need to take, they want to go to university in Paris or whatever. There are other stories that don't involve them being kidnapped by the big bad. I mean, you've got to be careful with dependent not to make it tragic.
Right.
Go on.
Diabolic Past, which we've seen relatively recently.
So, Tom, tell me about your time in York.
We are, of course, referring to characters who've got, had, you know, like an infernal master or been brought up in a convent where something strange was going on. But luckily, the Quaestors came in, sorted it all out, and burnt the place to the ground.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that if you were actually actively involved in diabolism, they might have burnt you to the ground as well.
Yes.
Hugh of Wombo famously had a diabolic past, but he had been the one who tipped off the Quisitors as an apprentice, and he had helped them, and had therefore survived the destruction of his covenant. But, again, you know, playing someone who's a victim of satanic ritual abuse...
Well, since we no longer live in the 1980s, probably okay, but not necessarily.
But Diabolic Past really can be, again, it's one that you've got to be careful with. It's up to you if you want to play it, but you should talk to the referee about how you want it to be.
Yeah. Difficult Underlings.
Now, this is classic Basil Fawlty, isn't it? For those who've seen Fawlty Towers. I mean, this could be just ridiculously comical.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a great one for your fellow players to do when you're when they're playing the grogs.
Yes.
Having your shield grogs constantly sassy because you've taken the floor.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's a lot of fun. If everybody in the Covenant takes it, it quickly becomes ridiculous and nothing ever happens.
Yes.
But difficult underlings, they don't have to be intentionally smart-mouthed and think you're an idiot. It could just be that, you know, you are unfortunately not very, what's the word I'm looking for? Charismatic?
Or they're too scared of you to actually do anything useful?
Or you just happen to, I mean, in my Regency Cthulhu game with the Blenkinsop sisters, they have Jane the maid, who unfortunately was dropped on her head as a baby and is therefore slightly more addled than a Norfolk dumpling. And, you know, they don't have to actually be... It might just be that you hire really unfortunate people because they're the only ones available.
Oh, that's also possible.
Who else would work for magicians?
Ah, people who enjoy bricking magicians up in their lab? Well, you never know. I mean, of course, the sort of people who might come to work for covenants are frequently people with social flaws or things that make them outcasts. Or people with unusual ideas and attitudes.
One of the things I like about the Order of Hermes is it's an island of modernity with modern liberal values in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
So it's anachronistic, deliberately, intentionally anachronistic. And it's a society of wizards who think like us. And that's why they have the gift. Because the rest of the world is the medieval world. And they are completely and utterly woke. They are totally... Wizards are completely at variance to the morality of those around them.
Yes.
And I think that's rather... That's what makes the game playable.
Yes.
I think if you played a game in which you had to act like grim medieval peasants and... Or, like, you know, actually live
have
out...
Have to live like a medieval lord and go, right, how do I treat the underlings as property? Yeah.
Yeah. I'll kill those ones. They're boring me. You know... We can't afford to feed all the peasants this year. Go and slaughter half of them so we've got some. I'm joking. It was nothing like that. But, you know, medieval attitudes are very different to ours.
Yes.
Keep going.
Enemies.
I think that's straightforward, really. I mean, you know.
So do you recommend that one as a good one for newcomers to take as a relatively straightforward? You can think of a good enemy to have.
Yeah. Yeah,
tell a story about it, and they can work it into the plot for you.
They can work it into the plot. And I mean, you know, the enemy, if the enemy is the King of England, it's going to work differently to if the enemy is the local baker. But Two-Ton Ted from Teddington, and he drove the baker's van. Mm. But whoever your rival is, whoever your enemy is, they can still, they can, you know, you can come up with a storyline.
Yeah.
Even if it is simply the local baker who is your love rival.
Okay. Favours.
You owe favours to someone, is that how it works?
Yes, that is how it works.
Read me the description of that one.
Okay, that one's going to be quite a lengthy one. Where are we? Sorry. Where's favours in the list? Sorry. I'm scrolling through the list. Common alphabet. Remind me, somewhere before the letter G, yes?
F, yes. It comes
that's
before G.
Good,
yes.
Good. Glad to know I've still got it. So, favours. You owe a boon to someone, or to a great many people. I mean, called upon to return the favour any time. The consequences of ignoring such a request can range from mild to deadly serious, and the story goes to discretion. So how do you make that work?
As a storyline, the obvious one is that you have either your family or a criminal organisation or a former employer you're indebted to, and there's something they want from the Covenant, just a minor secret or just a bit of information or just a lock of a major's hair. And slowly those requests become larger and larger. But you're indebted to them and you'll never be able to pay off that debt. It doesn't have to be a physical debt. It's a debt of, you know, it's a boon. Yeah. But they have something on you which stops you. Now, that's getting too close to blackmail, isn't it? But favours is something like that, where you owe something to someone else that leads you into stories. The classic example is, of course, you owe 40 days feudal service to a lord.
Yes.
Because you have a title, a land grant, and therefore you're expected to raise an army and go off to fight.
Which is fine if you're playing a fighting man companion, but is difficult for most other social stations.
Well, I mean, a clergyman might very well owe the bishop a certain degree of... where's the place? Up in... I think it's in Surrey. But there was a dragon there that was slain. And after the dragon was slain in the Middle Ages, the lord, the person who slew the dragon was made the lord of the area by the bishop. And until 1827, the last time, when the bishop enters the parish, the lord of the manor has to greet him and hand him the sword of the slayer. I can't remember what it was actually called, but the sword that was used to slay the dragon. The bishop would bless it and then it would be taken back again. But this was required every time the bishop passed through the parish. So they would have to... Yeah. So they would have to arrange for him to go down and meet him. So he couldn't leave because of this ancient custom. So the bishop would therefore have to divert. So in the end, they got it down to once a year when they would do it.
Right.
And then finally, after 1827, the Lord of the Manor said, no more. And he gifted the sword to the cathedral, and it's still in the cathedral today. I'll look up where it is. I've forgotten which one it is, but it's a genuine story. Well, okay. I don't know about the dragon slaying bit, but that is the story behind why. But the bishop's entering the parish on the road, you having to run down, that's a rather unusual favour, isn't it? Another thing is that favours can take the forms of feudal duties. Could be something like, you must produce 40 white eggs every Easter time.
Yeah.
Or you must bring me 3 geese every Christmas, and so forth. If those things are hard to get, or even magical, or turn out to be a wheat source, you can see why, you know, that suddenly becomes quite an interesting basis for a story. What's the next one?
Feud. Your family's involved in the feud.
Go on then, give us some examples, Tom, of what you think would work for that.
Well, it says the opposing family or families are roughly equivalent strength to your family and its allies. So if you're playing a noble character, that's quite straightforward. You have a rival noble family. If you're a merchant, okay, so there's another merchant. But you know, what if you're a priest? Also, how would that work for a magus?
Yeah. Well, also, the classic example of a feud, Montague and Capulets.
Yes.
So, yeah, Montague and Capulets. I think that Romeo and Juliet is a great
example. Two houses, both alike in dignity. You're right.
Yeah. My phone's ringing, so I'm just going to step outside while you carry on to the next one, which is what?
So the next one is Fury. So a violent temper sometimes overwhelms you.
Kill! Kill! Kill the Tom! Kill the Tom! Kill the Tom! Sorry. No.
So, setting into destructive, uncontrollable rage. So this one, this is a story for which there's an actual mechanic of rolling on a stress die. And also has the effect of, it actually has a mechanical thing of making you worse on your die rolls, but making you do extra damage. So, do you know what? There probably is possibility for a warrior to deliberately min-max by going, right, when my character gets into an absolute killing rage, he'll be absolutely brutal. But the possibility of you trying to kill everybody, yeah, potentially makes you unpopular with the other characters if you get so enraged you start trying to fight your friends. Yeah, oh yes, because if you botch, you try to kill everyone around you. Yes, myself and CJ do have experience of playing with people who end up, for one reason or another, their character tries to justify why they're going to try and do something really destructive, like rig up an explosive device within the player character's base of operations to detonate if something goes wrong, or leave some blackmail-worthy information so it can get leaked or something, or accidentally, brutally shoot another member of the party in the head. This usually ends up in a lot of ill-feeling and bad things, so generally, we should try and stop that. Anyway, so with the Fury one, it is best that it's only used by players you can trust, not to try and be a dick about it and kill everyone.
So not Luke. Anyway, yeah. Let's move on.
So the next one is Indiscreet.
Fury Accio is what I would advise not, because one of the problems with it is that you fail a dice roll, you lose control of your character, they turn into a murderous killing machine. It's just not a lot of fun to play. And in real life, would you stay around some violent psychopath who was like you stove your head in it for no reason? Just because it was too hot?
Well,
dang. Sorry.
It can happen, but yeah, in real life, people often leave such situations, yeah.
Yeah, you try and avoid hanging around nut jobs. Go on.
Indiscreet.
That one can be a complete pain in the... I mean, Phil basically used it as an excuse to tell every NPC he met all your secrets, didn't he?
Yes.
He was not just indiscreet, he was...
deliberately gossipy.
Gossipy to the nth degree. I mean, yeah, it's interesting. It makes you very unpopular with the other players.
Yeah.
And it can probably lead to conflict, but it's certainly an interesting one to play if you like playing a gossipy character who is either impossibly naive and therefore just tells people the truth, or who just... simply enjoys gossiping.
Yeah,
I think that's quite a fun one to play. What else is there?
Mistaken Identity.
The Prince and the Pauper. Mark Twain, was it?
Yeah. Or Twelfth Night.
Yeah. I mean, any of the Mistaken Identity storylines, and there are many. I mean, you know, I was thinking about doing a modern game in which you get mistaken for Taylor Swift. It seems entirely plausible, doesn't
yes.
it? Yeah. So, yeah, we could actually, you know, those kind of storylines where two people are so similar that they can swap roles.
Yes.
Or just one where you are...
Parent Trap, the hermetic version.
Or you are mistaken as being a murderer or someone else that you are believed to have done yes. something you haven't, could fall under that as well.
Yeah. Okay. Monastic Vows.
Yeah, now this is an interesting one, because if your character lives in a monastery, they could probably go out to work with the consent of the abbot. They would probably go out and work in the fields. They might possibly, if they're a prior, they might be responsible for dealing with the town folk or the coven folk.
Yep.
But generally speaking, monastic vows means that five times a day you're going to be attending prayers.
Yeah.
You'll be attending mass probably as well. And you're usually, you know, the liturgical hours at least must be observed. And you are bound by many things, including not possessing property. Playing such a character as a companion could work.
Yeah.
Cadfael would be your brother Cadfael. Yes. The Ellis Peters stories would be ideal.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, can you take monastic vows but not be attached? You could be a wandering friar, though they come in about 1224 in England. But there are orders of friars who are wandering around preaching.
Yeah.
Did I let Loki in here?
No, the cats are still outside. Right. That is why they are scratching at your door.
Okay, yeah. Right, yeah.
Oh, monastic vows. So realistically, it's going to restrict what you do quite a bit.
I think so.
Okay. Oath of fealty, classic one for noblemen. Who else could it work for?
Well, clergy, in a sense, owe fealty. A parish priest owes fealty to his bishop. The bishop owes fealty to the cardinal to the pope.
Yeah.
So there is the church is also a hierarchical structure. It could work very much, I suppose, for other characters. But wizards generally cannot take oaths of fealty. They are barred from it by the Code of Hermes, are they not? So if you've got one, it's really tantamount to saying...
Dark secret.
It's a dark secret, yeah. I think, generally speaking, but you can't take it as a magician, or if you do, you're in deep trouble as soon as anyone finds out.
So what happens if you're part of a huge hermetic conspiracy to cover up the truth, and you are personally wiping away any evidence of the secret?
Oh, what you mean, like the conspiracy to pretend that there was another house called House D'Edne?
Yes.
That was druidic and pagan and peace-loving and hippie?
Yes.
When in fact it never existed, it was simply, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing was created. And you remember the Gare Hill letter?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is possible, I suppose. Yeah, go on then.
We've got plagued by supernatural entity.
You can hear them even now scratching at the doorway.
Yes.
Yes. Her lovers queued up in the hallway. I heard them scratching at the door. I tried to tell her about Marks and Engels, God and Angels. I don't really know what for. Andrew Eldridge. Right. Yeah, the kittens trying to get in. Supernatural entities. You've got a whole bunch of different choices. Now, obviously, I know a bit about this area, and I think it should probably be another podcast. But I like boggarts. Boggarts are always fun, aren't they? Mischievous fairy entities who pursue you and cause chaos. Another possibility is just a brownie.
Okay.
I mean, okay, they look after your house, they keep things incredibly tidy, but unfortunately they constantly move your spell ingredients.
That might count more as a supernatural nuisance.
Yeah, that's more of a supernatural nuisance. So what's the definition of this one?
Okay, hang on. Let me check carefully, because again, this is going to be one where the difference between plagued by supernatural entity and supernatural nuisance is going to be small but significant. So, plagued by supernatural entities, some supernatural being interferes in your life on a fairly regular basis. It may even have your best interests at heart, but the result is that you get in stories. So it gives the example of a demon trying to corrupt you, or an angel trying to save you,
yeah,
or a ghost continuing the agenda they had while alive.
The ghost of your father who was murdered telling you to revenge him by taking out Claudius, King of Denmark.
Yes.
Hamlet is a story of a man who was plagued by a supernatural entity.
Whereas a supernatural nuisance, supernatural entities of a certain kind interfere in your life in minor ways whenever you're around them. So the entire point is not, they do not have long-term plans, but every time you meet a ghost, general enmity from fairies towards you.
So I think the difference would be plagued by supernatural entity is the fairy is your guardian angel who is trying to save your soul and does so in a manner that is intrusive and extremely. The demon whispers and is trying to steal your soul. The fairy is attached to you in some way you don't understand because it's basically trying to play your story out. And that the ghost is, you know, whereas with...
The ghost is what? Christian, not everybody has written as many books on ghosts as you have.
Okay, so ghosts generally, you can normally, the tradition in England is that you can invoke the Trinitarian formula of Father, Son, Holy Spirit. And then they are able to speak. And that once you ask them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit to speak, give them permission, then they can talk. That's medieval ghosts. Medieval ghosts also take on physical form. They can usually materialise. So if you annoy a ghost, it might beat you up, throw you over a hedge.
Yeah.
I'm going from the Byland Abbey's fragments. Yes. They tend to be quite physical. They might... Ghosts, generally, in classical to early modern periods, very often manifest in dreams or appear to one person only, and they are allowed to appear by the divine or the infernal for the purpose of imparting a method, a message. Now, in the period of Ars Magica, nobody thinks ghosts are demons, because the Bible speaks about spirits that are both good and evil. In fact, one of the gifts of the Holy Spirit is the ability to discern between true and false spirits, you know, between good and evil spirits. Yes. And that is also one of the virtues and flaws in this game.
Yeah.
We could talk a lot about ghosts. It's something I know about, but we'll leave it for today and move on. But supernatural nuisance, the difference is... You have a supernatural nuisance, which is ghosts generally, not just a ghost often. So all ghosts, you have the capacity to see ghosts. So the ghosts of the dead tend to attach themselves to you and follow you around because they want to tell you about their life stories, or they want to tell you about why they're still here, or they want to tell you about who killed them. But whether you want to hear it or not, you will end up with more and more ghosts as you walk across the countryside, whole churchyards. Now, most ghosts obviously receive Christian burial and are passed on, but it means that you are constantly dealing with the tormented spirits of the dead who seek burial. Fairies may, however, just find you deeply amusing and may find it truly tragic that you are in fact not, as they believe, the greatest dancer in mythic Europe, or prince of some small island, or whatever else. And therefore, they will attempt to carry this on by plaguing you and will attempt to push you in the direction of what they want to achieve.
Right.
They're control elements. Okay. We won't go into the whole Jacques Vallée control system hypothesis because that's too complex, but we'll do an episode on fairies sometime.
We can have the whole podcast series of CJ Explains Parapsychology and its relevance to 13th century Europe another time.
Yeah, let's carry on.
Tormenting master.
Your master decides to turn everybody in Glastonbury into a cow.
This has happened. Yes.
Yeah. Or, in fact, Kronos decides that he is going to reinvent himself as a vampire hunter because he believes that a certain house have been corrupted by vampirism. So he goes to Scotland and raises an army of giants to destroy your tribunal.
Yes. And other such fun things. That can happen. But Tormenting Master is frequently seen as a core part of the Toothless experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, if you're going to be dealing with emotional abuse, bullying, etc., etc., handle it sensitively with the player and the... Don't just, you know... Yeah.
And the final major one from the core book is True Love for an NPC.
Yeah, absolutely. But that means that your character is in love and you should expect that love story to be absolutely defining. And, of course, the true love might get kidnapped. Please don't kidnap them. It's so much more interesting to have a rival suitor or to have them not realise you're interested in them, or that the two of you are already... You've already got to the happily ever after phase. Just get a couple of Taylor Swift albums and work through the various collections of breakups, heartbreaks and misery that can follow. And all will be well in the end because it's true love.
Thank you. And if Taylor's management are listening, Christian is doing his best to get money to advertise the Tortured Poets Department.
Yes, yes, yes. If you'd like to go out and buy the Tortured Poets, and if Taylor would like to take me out on a day, I am available on Tuesdays.
Yeah. Although your girlfriend might think otherwise.
Oh, yeah, that's true, actually. I forgot about my girlfriend, yeah.
Anyway, minor story flaws. So these ones which have got plenty of upside, but they will drag into stories. So they count as a minor flaw. So you've got animal companion and magical animal companion.
Yeah, well, they're what they sound like. You've got an animal, And hopefully the referee will not try and kill it off. Magical animal companions usually last as long as your character does. Animal companions, again, I would normally assume that they have offspring, or that they live longer than most normal ones. Nobody wants to play having their beloved pet dying halfway through a story. So I think magical animal companion is the better option.
And this is the story where your beloved animal goes to live on a farm far away.
Yes, where your pet dog dies. Yeah, nobody wants to play that. And again, I don't normally kill off animal companions unless they become familiars, and even then I don't kill them off.
Okay. Blackmail?
What about him?
No, I'm referring to the story.
Sorry, okay. Yeah, okay. So you could...
Worth 120 pennies a year by the wording of the rules.
Right, okay. So somebody is blackmailing you for about a third of your income, basically. I'm just trying to work out what you...
No, I think it's you are blackmailing them.
Oh, you're blackmailing them. Okay. Right. Well, that's a lot of money. I mean, the average worker gets about a penny a day.
Oh, sorry. It's worth about 50 silver pennies. Sorry, in according to the rules as written.
Right, 50 silver pennies. So it's like 2 months' income.
Yeah.
So in modern terms, let's say the modern income is about, what, 20,000?
25, maybe.
Maybe. I mean, nobody I know owns that much. That's more money than I've ever seen. Let's call it 2,000. About 4,000 pounds a year. So it's a significant amount of money, isn't it?
Yeah.
So why would you want to play a blackmailer?
I don't know. Maybe you just want to have the secrets, or maybe you just want to have your character having a bit of money on the side they don't have to do much to get.
Yeah, I mean, I might be tempted to allow you to blackmail a magician for a pawn of beasts or something.
Yeah.
But being the victim of blackmail seems far more interesting to me than being the actual blackmailer. But yeah, okay. Either way, I guess you could do something about it, but I don't know.
Okay, close family ties.
Yeah, okay. What's the definition of that one?
That's the one where you have a lot of family members and, you're close to them.
That doesn't seem like much of a story.
Presumably it's because you've got so many relatives to do stuff. So it says, your family is one of the most important things in your life and still supports and aids you whenever possible, even at personal risk, so quite a bit upside.
Oh, okay, so
but
this
family
is...
family members do not hesitate to do any favours in their power. But it works both ways.
So you're going to tell stories. Your family have to live near to you, obviously, for this to work. So you can't be a black sheep and take close family.
No.
So, or could you actually? No.
No.
So, yeah, you've got a family and your mum and dad are constantly having troubles. Your brother keeps being swept away down the river. Your little sister has a pet goose and you have to rescue it occasionally. You know, it's going to have those kind of stories.
Okay, fairy friend.
Again, read me the definition, because I probably misunderstood it.
What a wonderful example you set of your...
Okay, so my first thought of this is E.T. But go on.
Right, yes. You can tell this is not one that any of our characters can retake. So, fairy friend, you have an ally among the Fae. How much assistance you can get depends on the power of the friend. So a small fairy will come to your day-to-day basis. Powerful fairies will only be able to answer questions.
So, do you have...
Hang on a moment. So, yeah, so the fairy friend is saying it can be a boon, but it can also be a burden if it's nasty or mischievous.
Okay, so two classic examples. You might have an invisible 6-foot white rabbit friend called Harvey.
Yes.
Or you might have, and this again, you know, the same thing, E.T. You might have a fairy that you're trying to hide from others.
Yes.
That has come into your life and is deeply bizarre. Any of those kind of films about outsider creatures that come into your world and that... Can other people see the fairy? Does the fairy have a relationship with them? Are they frightened of it? Is it something really weird? Does the fairy only appear to you? You know, these are questions to ask. But it's a dramatic, it's a good story for it. I like it. Yeah. Next.
Air.
Air. H-E-I-R.
Yes.
I remember years ago, there was an article in White Dwarf or Adventure or Imagine or one of those magazines that said, being an heir sounds like a great storyline. This was for D&D.
Yeah.
But not if it turns out after the whole campaign you were heir to a baker's shop.
Yeah.
Actually, in Ars Magica, being heir to a baker's shop might be a major story.
Yeah, so, well, it could, because it could be the start of your way to fame and fortune. Or it could be what your characters always wanted.
Being the heir to something doesn't necessarily mean you're heir to the throne of England or heir to a knighthood or something like that. You might be heir to an artistic reputation. Heir can mean so many things, and I think there's just so many storylines that can follow. That's always a really good one to take. And as you only get one of these, you need to choose well.
Mentor.
Yeah, you've got a character who supports you, helps you, and is... And if you've taken this as your story flaw, you're obviously going to have problems in the relationship, or they're going to get into trouble, or somehow it's going to drag you in. But the mentor is usually going to provide you with good advice and is going to be a positive character in the campaign. So when the bad things happen, then you know they're going to be, I mean, hopefully the referee doesn't have them spontaneously combust or something, but instead you might have to rescue them, or, and I mean, the nice thing,
their case at tribunal,
whatever, something like that. And after all, you could always replace a story flaw with another story flaw if the first story flaw runs out of potential.
The final one for the core book, visions.
Now that's a hard one. I'm going to leave that one to you, Tom.
So with visions, I mean, you can just use it as the handy, let me tell you what's happening in the plot line. The GM tells you, here's tonight's plot line. Your character's a vision of something happening somewhere. Yes, this is the big obvious clue for you to get involved. But that can be a bit dull.
I mean, it could be visions of the Virgin, though they are much later, centuries after our period, most Marian apparitions. It could be visions of a far-off place that you are... The classic vision is the story is of the Peddler of Swaffham, do you know?
No.
Or are they Bungie? No, that's Swaffham, I think. So, the Peddler of Swaffham is asleep one night, and he has a dream, and he wakes up in the morning, and he tells his wife, I dreamt that I was crossing London Bridge, and there I met a man who told me the location of a great golden treasure. And his wife said, well, you're an idiot. Everybody dreams about treasures, and everybody dreams about it. London's about 150 miles away. You mean to tell me that you're not going to go out and do your work today, because instead you're going to spend a week walking to London on the off chance that you're going to meet some character on a bridge who's just going to tell you that he knows where there's a great golden treasure. Why, go and dig it up himself. And the peddler says, stuff you, I'm going. So he walks off and he goes all the way to London. And along the way, he meets various characters, an innkeeper and various a priest. And they all tell him the same thing, that he's just filled his head with stuff and fancies. And that nothing of the sort ever... We all dream things every night. And if every dream came true, then you know. And he gets to London Bridge and he's there. And he sees a merchant coming the other way. And he says to the merchant, excuse me, sir, but I've had a dream. And the merchant laughs him and says, tell me nothing of your dreams. Who cares about dreams? Why, last night I dreamt that there was a cottage in a small town in Norfolk called Swaffham. And that there, under a broken tree, there was a pot of gold. At which point, the peddler said, sorry to have bothered you, and turned home and headed home. And a week later, he got home, and his wife said, I don't know what I'm going to do, me and the children, with you running off to London and coming back with wild stories. And he went out, and he pulls up the stump of the tree, and he digs down, and there he finds a clay pot filled with gold. And his wife said, see, I told you you should pay attention to that dream. And he became very rich and went on to become, I don't know, mayor of Swaffham, which is probably not the most...
Anyway, so visions, could work as an interesting one if people have interesting dreams.
Most visions in the Middle Ages revolve around either religious themes or finding treasure. Right. People in the Middle Ages seem to have been obsessed with finding treasure. And in fact, I have a grimoire. It dates from the early 15th century, I think, possibly even 16th. And it's good fun. We used it when we were looking, when we were writing Magnonia, the role-playing game of Elizabethan witchcraft. Yes. And sorcery and magic, which yes. you should clearly all own, that and the Bestiary of Enchanted England.
Yeah.
I assume everybody here owns a copy of Shoestone Press's Magnonia, written by Tom and CJ and Andrew Granowski. But when we were looking at that, the Foreman grimoire, with an E, from spells are primarily for the finding of treasure
or
lost property, or for making women come to your house, dance and raise their skirts,
which of course is very important and shows that humanity has really not changed in the last 5 centuries.
It is true that getting ladies to undress in your house while dancing or act as if they were drunk, but generally just raise their skirts. That seems to be, people just wanted to see their bums. That does seem to be the basic obsession of whoever wrote the Foreman. It was like Beavis and Butthead do magic.
Now there's a role-playing game.
It's in the Bodleian, and I can't remember the manuscript number, but you can look it up.
There's your next role-playing project.
Beavis and Butthead do magic.
Yes.
That sounds horrendous. I think I lived that in the 80s. Right, okay.
My name is Cornholio, and I'm a great sorcerer.
Yeah, that was quite a good impression. Right, okay, carry on.
That was it. That is the list. So, we've been talking for nearly an hour. So, there we are. We've gone through all the story flaws. CJ, what's the best one for a newcomer?
For a newcomer, I would be tempted to go with Air. It doesn't have to be defined. It doesn't have any great negative ramifications. Possibly might do. But Air strikes me as fun. Fairy Friend strikes me as another great one. What are your favourites, Tom?
My favourite, mine would be Mentor, because it's just nice to have somebody else looking out for you. And yeah, the downsides are manageable. If I was going for something major, I'm just trying to think. Generally, I would say something like Difficult Underlings to have that mundane relationship is probably better than any of the big supernatural ones for a newcomer.
And I'd always be tempted by Curse of Venus, because of course, when, like me, inappropriate women endlessly fall in love with you because you're so beautiful, well, what can you do?
And on that note, we'll leave it for tonight. You've been listening to our
Deluded is not actually it's a personality one, mate.
It's a personality rather than a story one.
Oh,
yes.
Okay then. Thank you very much. So you've been listening to Chris and Tom.
Yeah.
And so it's good night from me.
That's good night for me.
Good night.
All right.